Welcome to Worlds Apart. Most of us would agree that a bad peace is better than a good war, although it may be just as heartless, if not more, to the preservation of life and the nature of human condition. But once a war begins and political moralizing exhausts itself, what factors need to be in place in order to end it once and for all? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Richard Rubenstein, professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. Professor Rubenstein, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you wrote in one of your recent articles that the best time to undertake peace talks is when the parties, the warring parties, having stepped up their military efforts, declare that they would never, ever talk to the enemy. Do you think we have reached that point in Ukraine?
I think that we're approaching it. We may not have reached it quite yet, but I think we're getting very close to it, to that point. In fact, a number of us who are studying the conflict and who are in conflict resolution are sensing that the tide seems to be turning. You know that it's been very, very difficult for people like me and many of my colleagues who think that there should be negotiations and soon. It's been very difficult for us to get a hearing. The mainstream newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so forth, are not running our op-eds or our letters to the editor. And even a very distinguished group of people, I mean, people like Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia or Richard Falk at Princeton and others are finding themselves, have been silenced. But I think this is changing. And in fact, I noticed even in the New York Times this morning, there's a quote from an expert in the RAND Corporation who is beginning to talk about the possibility of negotiations. And
well, before we go more deeply into that, can I actually pose what I think is the most crucial question in discussing the possibility of peace talks? And that is, who are the warring parties? Who do you think are the sides to this indeed horrific and heartbreaking conflict?
Well, and I certainly agree with you about both horrific and heartbreaking. And I think that the parties in conflict resolution, the usual rule is that you negotiate with the parties who are most alienated and who are using violence against each other, so that the immediate parties would be Ukraine and Russia. But it seems clear, especially given the history of this conflict and given the issues that are involved in it, that the negotiations can't stop there. They might well start with Ukraine and Russia and deal with issues immediately in dispute between those two countries. But they would have to proceed to a next phase in which Europe and the United States were also involved.
I think that's, again, a very interesting and indeed a crucial point, whether the talks need to start or proceed to involve the United States. Because when we consider the openness of the parties, Russia is open for negotiations. I mean, Moscow produces statements almost on a daily basis that it's open for talks. It is the Ukrainian leadership that passed certain legislation banning itself from engaging in the talks. But is any of that relevant without a more explicit and, frankly, more genuine and more principled position of the United States on the issues of war and peace in Ukraine? Again, taking into account all the context, the undersurface, underground context that led to this war.
Yeah, yes, no, I think you make a very good point. They will have to, when we think about how the war began, and I have to say that, in my opinion, I think for Russia to have moved against Ukraine as it did, I think was a mistake. The one who strikes the first blow is always at a disadvantage afterwards. But even so, that conflict, that blow, it may be, have been unjustly struck, but it was not unprovoked. There was a deliberate refusal to discuss major security issues with Russia and with President Putin, who wanted to discuss these, wanted to talk about a restructuring of the European security architecture. And that has to be done, it seems to me, that issue has not disappeared. It hasn't gone away. Certainly, if the United States were in the same position, having, you know, rocket bases positioned on its borders and so forth, that we would, you know, we wouldn't sit back and take it either. So those issues have got to, it seems to me, reappear at some stage in the negotiations, even if not in the first stage.
You described Russia's decision to move into Ukraine as a mistake. I think that's a huge and existential tragedy for Russia. You know, all the strategic calculations notwithstanding, I think it's still a major tragedy for our people, because many of us have relatives in Ukraine and we suffer from that war. Not as much as the Ukrainians, but it pains us a huge deal. But going back to the strategic issues, as far as I know, more than half of Ukraine's current budget is subsidized by the West. Many of the weapons it's using on the battlefields come either from the West or with the help of Western financing. And many Western countries, and first and foremost the United States, in its doctrinal documents, strategic documents, describe Russia as an enemy, as an adversary, and advocate the policy of active containment of my country through NATO expansion. Do you think that war would ever be able to come about or be sustained without the help of the United States?
No. I think the United States was a moving party in the war, and the United States' domination of NATO is also clear. The great tragedy is, I think, really exactly as you say, that U.S.-Russia relations have been framed in terms of this intense animosity, and not simply based on disagreements over policy, but something that goes deeper. And some of my colleagues and I have been trying to analyze this. We've been working for 2 or 3 years, talking to people and so forth, trying to find out where this is coming from. Why such intense animosity? If you take a newspaper like the New York Times, I mean, you simply can't find an article that has anything nice to say about Russia at all. And by the way, they don't have anything nice to say about China. So one possibility is that the U.S. position in the world now, in some ways, is being challenged. The U.S. position in the world has become uncertain, and it's a very strange situation, since the U.S. is by far the dominant military power in the world. As several people have said, not since the Roman Empire has one power been so militarily dominant. And yet there are signs of weakening of this, this global hegemony. There's a kind of defensiveness about the United States position.
When you say that there is animosity, I think it's one-sided animosity. The Russians don't hate the Americans. I mean, I myself studied in the United States. We read the American literature. We have many friends in the United States. And the American lifestyle has long been infatuated here in Russia. But when you say that the America feels challenged, I don't understand, what is that challenge? I mean, do we challenge the American state by the very fact of our existence, by the very desire to develop ourselves or our neighborhood, by our, I think, birth-given right to build connections with our neighbors and with other countries? What is it that is challenging the United States from our side?
The United States, I think, is not being challenged by Russia. I think the challenges are of a different sort. I mean, my own feeling about it, when I say defensive, by the way, what I'm trying to point out is that very often aggressive activities and antisocial activities are the result of a person feeling threatened, feeling
Or feeling the fear. Exactly. That's the underlying emotion there. But what I'm trying to understand is, what is it that the United States is fearing, given that, again, it's the most powerful country of the world, it's the most prosperous country of the world. It still has lots of the leverages to, you know, produce outcomes that it desires. What is it that's threatening it on the inside?
I'm almost tempted to tell you, go back and look at the history of the late Roman Empire. And you'll see a nation that was threatened not so much from outside, but by internal divisions and unsolved social problems. I mean, the U.S. is a nation which, in many ways, it's got a wonderful history and it's done wonderful things, but it also is one of the most unequal societies on earth. There's a radical growth in inequality, social and economic inequality. The very rich have never been richer. Pretty much everybody else compared with them is poor. There's great suffering among large sections of the population in the country, and particularly people living in deindustrialized areas and in urban ghettos and so on. There's tremendous suffering. And yet, these problems are not being solved for reasons that we could talk about.
Professor Rubenstein, I'm sure you would agree with me that projecting those problems onto other nations is not going to help the situation. I'm sure those elites of people in power who are trying to make those strategic decisions, including a decision to, you know, pump Ukraine with weapons or provoke China over Taiwan incessantly, I'm sure they understand that this in and of itself is not going to help the, you know, power divide or the income divide within the United States. What do you think is their ultimate motivation? What are they trying to get for themselves, for their own people there?
Well, it's not rational. When when you talk about motivation, you're talking about rationality. And what I'm saying is that when people are feeling threatened by internal disunity, people feeling, if you look at the polls and ask people in the U.S. how they think the country is doing, the great mass of people say they think it's doing very badly. And people start looking around for scapegoats, especially, you know, if you've been taught not to blame your own system, if you're not supposed to be thinking about ways that the system could be restructured to become more fair and equitable and so forth to everybody, there's a tendency to strike out at others, at scapegoats. I mean, that's one part of it. The other part of it, and the answer to your question, it seems to me, is that the world in many ways is becoming multipolar. That the U.S. has been the sole superpower, really, now for some considerable period of time, for decades. But now we're dealing not only with Russia, which is in many ways resurgent, great power, China, which is clearly a great power. Can this country learn to deal and to operate in a multipolar world as one great power among others? That's a big question, and it's going to take some re-education here. It's going to take some work on our part to accept that new reality.
Professor Rubenstein, let's discuss some of the ways how the United States can take that very difficult and perhaps unpleasant lesson after a short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Putin is the aggressor. Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions.
Today, Russia is the country with the most sanctions imposed against it, a number that's constantly growing.
Стратегия сейчас направлена на сокрушение российской экономики, на нанесение максимального ущерба.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
Sucks, we're suffering the price for something that's happening in another country.
Вопрос узловой, который сейчас решается, это судьба доллара как мировой резервной валюты.
Joe Biden, in imposing these sanctions on Russia, you know, has destroyed the American economy. So there's your boomerang effect. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Richard Rubenstein, Professor of Conflict Resolution and Public Affairs at George Mason University. Professor Rubenstein, before the break, we were talking about this very convenient habit on the part of the American elites to sort of project their own incompetency onto other nations and constantly search for external enemy. Unconscious as it may seem, there are also many people who believe that that is a deliberate policy, deliberate strategy on the part of American decision makers. And as you can imagine, here in Moscow, there are not many people who believe in moral or democratic underpinnings of American actions in Ukraine. But many here give Washington a credit for actually being quite strategic and rational, because they believe that, you know, whether we like it or not, Washington has succeeded in pitting Ukraine against Russia. And it succeeded doing that at a very low cost, you know, roughly $19 billion and, you know, thousands of Ukrainian and Russian, but not American lives. And from a strategic point of view, that's not a bad outcome. Do you think that's really something that came without any deliberate thought on the part of American decision makers?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what's deliberate and what's not deliberate. I think that the decision to support Ukraine, but the decision to support Ukraine, I mean, you might say in one way it was made quite early. It was made in 2014, if not earlier, because the weapons flow started to Kyiv started in, you know, in large scale at that time. So it was not simply a response to the invasion, although the invasion made it in some ways impossible for Washington not to respond. But I think you're right to note at the beginning of your statement that there is some rationality involved here. And I think it's important to point out that all sides in this war, both sides, especially Russia and the United States, have in some ways limited the kinds of military activity that they're engaged in. There's a lot of self-limitation going on both sides. I mean, the United States has armed the Ukrainians to the teeth, but and with many modern weapons, but has avoided giving them weapons that could strike deep into
Well, some would argue that the only reason for that is to maintain the appearance of a proxy war and prevent it from, becoming a true kinetic war. Because if that happens, the cost to the United States would be much higher than they are at the moment. So again, this could be, a rational way of waging a war but pretending not to wage a war. Which brings me to a question we sort of touched before but didn't quite answer. Do you think there are any motivation at this point of time for the United States to support peace talks? What could be possible peace benefits for the United States? Because from a strategic point of view, it seems to be getting quite a lot.
Well, and that's where I think there's a change in the air, that things are starting to shift. The United States is as an electoral democracy, as a country divided between two parties, has probably never been more intensely divided, at least not since the American Civil War, has it been so intensely divided between the Democrats and Republicans. But also it's very evenly divided. And I think that in this kind of situation, the Democrats are starting to realize it's a major mistake for them to be giving the Republicans a peace plank in their platform, to be giving the peace issue, turning the peace issue over to the Republicans. And I don't think they want to go into, I mean, it didn't hurt them that much in the election that's just taken place for various reasons. I think the main reason being that the election was really about Donald Trump. And a few issues like abortion, much more than about foreign policy. But I don't think the Democrats want to go into 2024 with this war going on.
I think you actually helping us here very handsomely to connect the two issues, the American foreign policy and the internal divide that the United States is facing. And I wonder, as somebody who analyzes international conflicts, I'm sure you have a certain perspective on what could possibly help the United States heal its internal wounds. One thing that I noticed is that in the run-up to these midterm elections, both the Republicans and the Democrats portrayed the victory of the other side as a major existential threat to the country. And the Republicans did it as much as the Democrats. I think the Democrats actually did it even more than the Republicans. Do you take that as just fiery, convenient rhetoric, or is it indeed a sign of a perilous gap between the, not just the two parties, but between the two parts of the United States?
Yes, I think it is a sign of a perilous gap. And in fact, my university is, we're doing a forum on November 18th. We're going to do an all-day Zoom forum on the underlying causes of this polarization and what can be done about it. On the one hand, I think it is dangerous. On the other hand, I have to say that in conflicts like this, and also you might say the same thing about Ukraine, you can reach a point that the people in conflict resolution call the painful stalemate, in which both sides are hurting. Neither side is able to win a decisive victory. Neither side is going to say, we're going to win a total victory, unconditional surrender and all of that. That's not in the cards. And when you have a painful stalemate and neither side can win totally, and then there's hope of a decent, of a peace with honor, of a just peace, then I think conditions are actually ripe for conflict resolution. And I think that may be also true in the case of our domestic conflicts here. That is, people are really getting tired. When you think about, think about Northern Ireland, for example, where the violent troubles were taking place, and all of a sudden a group of women organized a peace movement in Northern Ireland for both Catholics and Protestants, and the main message of the movement is, we're tired of this violence and it's not getting us anywhere. So let's do something different. Well, I think there's that feeling, I think, is growing here. And I'm hoping and praying that it grows faster, because I think the way out of our current impasse is to start reconsidering some basic questions about the way we do business in this country, in the U.S. and in the West in general. Mm-hmm. So many of the problems that divide us are really soluble if we would think in more imaginatively about ways of forms of social reconstruction.
You mentioned this conference that your university is going to be hosting soon, and I'm sure it's not going to feature any Russian experts, although I think the Russians could bring you some very interesting perspective on that. And I want to use this opportunity to quote one of the Russian analysts who I thought had a very interesting analysis of the U.S. midterm campaigning. And he suggested that over the last couple of years, what's been happening in the United States is essentially a match between fear and fury. The Democrats are trying to milk the fear as much as they want or as they can. The Republicans are trying to ride on the fury, and both are very strong, very potent emotions, but not very productive. They accelerate the dynamic, but they don't create anything lasting. And you mentioned some of the perhaps grassroots effort of reaching out to the other side, but do you think the American system at this point of time, the electoral system, will allow those initiatives, those grassroots goodwill initiatives, to sort of rise up to the upper echelons and make the politics in general more cooperative and more productive for the society as a whole?
Well, I would have to say that they would. Of course, the elites will resist change because they're profiting from the current situation, but. I think there are possibilities. At least our history, also your history, suggests that when people organize strongly on a local level, when they get fed up enough, and when a new generation of leadership appears, change is possible. So, you know, I'm hopeful. And when I talk to my students, when I see what some of the young people are doing, when I see what, you know, peace organizations, for example, in Washington, D.C. are doing, and I see, for example, the development of a stronger and stronger feeling that there ought to be negotiations in Ukraine, then it makes me hopeful that the elites will be forced to listen.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and many other thinkers have commented on the proliferation of weapons in the United States, over 400 million guns in a country of 330 million people. And I think it's one thing to own a gun for self-protection. It's quite another thing to point it at another human being. We all have sort of built-in natural safeguards against that. And most people only do that when their very sense of security, existential security, is threatened. I wonder if the political divide, at least the way you feel it, the way you sense it, because there's no way of objectively answering to this question, do you think the political divide has reached such a proportions when people would associate their immediate survival with political issues?
Well, it's not quite there yet. I mean, the movement is dangerous. You know, the direction of in which things are going is dangerous. Most people are not buying guns now because they are getting ready to fight a civil war against the left against the right or the whatever. But when they buy guns, it very often indicates it's a complicated business. But one of the things that it indicates is a deep distrust, not even so much of the other party in this political conflict, but a deep distrust of authority. And if you ask people in the states where gun owning is most frequent and guns are a kind of sacred issue, and you ask them why do you think you need the gun? I mean, clearly you don't need a military style automatic weapon to go hunting. So why are you buying these automatic weapons? And they will tell you that they are afraid that the government is going to become tyrannical. It seems irrational and bizarre. But then, of course, you realize that these are people who are feeling betrayed very often by government. These are people who have the promises made to them have not been delivered. Promises of prosperity and security and happy family lives, and their children will do better than they will do. You know,
And their ability to even express those hopes, I think, is very highly constrained. I attest to that as a journalist, a Russian journalist with American education. But you cannot reach American audiences unless you subscribe to a certain point of view. I mean, I think the level of censorship in the United States at this point of time is tyrannical. And I'm saying that as somebody who has a very good knowledge of Russian propaganda and the censorship in this country. But as much as I hate it, we have to put an end to this conversation too, because we exhausted our time. So I'm really appreciative of your thoughts and your agreement to talk to us at this point of time.
And we're very happy to do it. Thank you for asking me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.